Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the February 3rd edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is Inside the Fight Against a Los Angeles Inferno. Annals of Disaster, Inside the Fight Against a Los Angeles Inferno by M.R. O'Connor. On the seventh day of the Eaton Fire, the most lethal of several wildfires burning in Southern California, I woke up in a tent at the Rose Bowl, which had become a staging area for the first responders, called Fire Camp. At 7 a.m., an emergency management team, known as Incident Command, gave a briefing at the stadium entrance. We were told that the blaze now encompassed 14,000 acres and was only 15% contained. It had risen into the San Gabriel Mountains to the north and spread into the suburbs to the south. It does not get much worse than it's going to be the next few days, an expert on fire behavior warned us. We could have rapid fire spread in basically any direction. At 8 o'clock, I climbed into one of the several white pickup trucks as part of the 20-person hand crew, a team of wildland firefighters who dig lines around fires to contain and control them. If fire engines are the artillery of firefighting and air tankers and helicopters are the Air Force, hand crews are the infantry. Our caravan drove east to Sierra Madre, a community of 11,000 in the foothills of the mountains. Police officers parked on the streets to enforce mandatory evacuation orders, waved us through, and we unloaded at the eerily vacant Eaton Canyon Golf Course. Behind us, the houses were untouched, but we knew that in front of us, hundreds of homes had been reduced to rubble. Nearly everyone in the crew carried hand tools, and two people, designated sawyers, carried chainsaws. We shrugged our backpacks, which included silver, cocoon-like fire shelters that we could deploy if we were overtaken by flames, and lined up. "Assume you're not coming back to the trucks till tonight," our captain instructed. "Stay vigilant, stay alert." We began to hike along the edge of the burn scar, the charred area that a fire leaves behind. Our job was to cold trail, to scour the boundary where the fire had stopped, looking for hot spots that could reignite. Walking side by side, we marched into drainage ditches, scaled chain link fences, crossed cul-de-sacs, and passed through backyards that sloped steeply upward toward the mountains. Each of us was responsible for scanning the ground for anything that might hold heat. At one end of the line, a crew member shouted, "Feel all white ashes. Don't pass the person on your left." Each firefighter repeated the message, one person to the next, as though it were an echo. When we saw ashes, we touched them gently with the backs of our bare hands to detect warmth. If we felt any, we shouted, "Hold for heat." And the line stopped long enough for us to dig the hot spot out of the earth and cool it in the open air. Cold trailing is extremely dirty and laborious work, but this is by design. Aerial imaging can detect hot spots and show crews like this where to look, but every inch has to be checked by a person in order for an area to be declared fully contained. The perimeter of a wildfire is typically walked over 3 or 4 times, and sometimes more. By California standards, the Eaton Fire was not especially large. It wasn't even close to being a mega fire, which is generally defined as one that burns at least 100,000 acres. But it was already the fifth deadliest fire in the state's history, with confirmed death toll of 17, with authorities still searching for victims. The destruction in parts of Altadena, a few miles to the west of Sierra Madre, and Pacific Palisades, which had burned in a separate fire on the other side of Los Angeles, made these areas appear bombed out. Sierra Madre looked like a place where missiles had fallen here and there. The damage was not total. We would circle the charred husk of a house and find a backyard pool whose water was black with ash, yet neighboring homes would be unscathed. A chief with CAL FIRE, the state agency that fights wildfires, drove with the crew and stopped to talk with the captain. Some of the homes in the neighborhood had basements, he said, and this raised concerns that people had sought shelter underground and perished. As of January 20th, there were more than 20 people missing. Looking inside the burned homes, I found it difficult to recognize anything at all, but one time I saw what looked like a blue and white vase. Miraculously, it was still upright. When I looked closer, I realized that it might be an urn, a container for ashes in the ashes. The hand crew I had joined referred to its captain as D. At midday, D instructed everyone to break for water and food in the backyard of a burned house. I peeled the first of two mandarin oranges that I'd plucked from a tree. We'd seen lemons whose rinds had started to melt away, but these were perfect orange orbs. After eating the first, however, I thought of the toxic air, chemicals from burning houses and cars that had swirled around the fruit for hours. I threw the second mandarin into some bushes. Dee began his career as a firefighter in his late 20s, when he was serving time in state prison. More than 1,000 of the firefighters who have worked Southern California's deadly fires this year are currently incarcerated. In an emergency like this, they might earn a few dollars an hour. Unlike the vast majority of wildland firefighters, he is black. While we rested, he leaned against his pack, a gray helmet on his head, but he didn't eat or drink anything. As a practicing Muslim, he chose to fast on Mondays and Thursdays, a reminder, he told me, of those who have no food or water. After 7 years of fighting fires, he had recently decided to move on. The Eaton Fire would be his last assignment. He had a baby girl at home and another child on the way, and he wanted to spend time with them. He planned to focus on a side business, cleaning windows and gutters, and a PhD in Islamic studies. I asked him if he would miss firefighting. Yes, he said. If I was rich and I could choose anything to do for a living, I would choose this work. What have you learned about fire? I view it as kind of an animal. If you take away the air, it dies. You can feed it by giving it more fuel. It can sleep. That's basically what we're doing now, finding dormant fire. It's an entity that you have to respect, not just some dumb element that, if you put water on it, it stops. As he spoke, I realized that we were sitting in front of what had been someone's bedroom. The blackened timbers of the roof had caved in on a scorched mattress and a blue bedspread. If we are going to live in places where fires like to burn, Dee went on, we need to become comfortable with small or controlled fires that consume accumulating fuel. Fire was here before us, Dee told me. It's good for the earth. Everything grows back better. It keeps the tree density down. We interfered with that and created these conditions. Research has shown that during the 20th century, a combination of aggressive wildfire suppression, temperature increases, and water scarcity encouraged the growth of smaller, more tightly clustered trees across much of California. Now, when wildfires start, they're hard to stop, Dee said. Our break was almost over. We had half a day of cold trailing ahead of us. Before we got back on our feet, Dee asked a question. How do we live in peace with fire? I spent 3 nights at fire camp, embedded with a private wildland firefighting company that had been hired as a contractor. Several of my sources requested that I use only their first names. I had previously trained as a wildland firefighter and maintained my qualifications. So I worked alongside the crew when I wasn't reporting. We slept in the Rose Bowl parking lot, not far from supply depots, laundry and shower facilities, therapy dogs, and kitchens that fed more than 2,000 first responders. Almost every major fire has a camp like this one, a fairground or a sports field where a command center can operate and people can recuperate between shifts. Of course, most fires are not 10 miles from downtown Los Angeles. The community affected by these blazes, in some way, encompassed millions of people, including many who were wealthy and influential. The national news coverage and the public's response were unusually intense. At one point, the rapper The Game brought firefighters coffee and paid to have fire engines detailed. At breakfast one morning, I heard a rumor that Angelina Jolie had attended one of the incident commands briefings, and she was photographed at the stadium alongside World Central Kitchen workers. The hand crew had difficulty believing that they were being treated so well. A McDonald's trailer showed up at the stadium and handed out free breakfasts. Food trucks doled out burgers and tacos. Locals arrived with portable grills and fed anyone who passed by. "It's one of the coolest things I've ever seen on a fire," I overheard a crew member say. Out on the line one day, a firefighter expressed his shock that he had been given a pillow and, moreover, that it was still sealed in plastic. "It was brand new," he said. Another jokingly compared these offerings to the miracles of the loaves and fishes. At night, the temperature was near freezing. I pulled my sleeping bag over my head to keep warm and looked at my phone. I wanted to understand how people outside the camp were processing and extracting meaning from the fires. An interview with the actor Dennis Quaid looked shaken as he evacuated his home, seemed weirdly profound. "We've all had a really big lesson," he told a TV reporter. "What is it?" the reporter asked. "That our experience of reality can change in a moment." An entire city, maybe an entire country, was starting to appreciate that the reality that wildland firefighters inhabit. Dirty work is often assumed to be unenlightened work, but wildland firefighters have a unique empirical understanding of natural forces. This includes troubling facts, such as the distance that floating embers can travel, miles, and the speed with which a wind-driven fire can move, about 10% of prevailing wind speeds. Firefighters also have access to a ground truth that is out of reach for the general public, and even for many scientists, about how our world is changing. In the past 10 years, they have witnessed new and dramatic kinds of weather, unfamiliar fire behavior, and blazes that grow to an unprecedented size and intensity. Firefighters told me again and again how much they love their job, the physical labor, the adrenaline, and the freedom of working in the outdoors. But they expressed how frustrated they were that as a society, we are not doing routine work, creating defensible space around communities, managing landscapes, igniting prescribed fires to help prevent such devastation. The most visible part of the Eaton Fire was in the suburbs, where it destroyed thousands of structures. The largest part of the fire, however, was burning through woods and chaparral, shrubland, in the mountains, largely out of sight of the public. Many firefighters were working in the Angeles National Forest, miles north of Sierra Madre and Altadena. This is the landscape that gives wildland firefighters their name. On my first day embedded with a firefighting company, day 6 of the fire, I joined a separate crew that drove north from camp, following a twisty highway uphill for an hour. We passed a law enforcement vehicle that was blocking the road to the public. After parking on the shoulder, we clambered out of the trucks, shivering in the morning air as we changed out of hoodies and jackets and into yellow shirts made of Nomex, which is fire resistant up to 700 degrees Fahrenheit. We lined up with our packs and tools, then set off at a fast pace along a dirt trail that hugged the mountain. In a hand crew, physical stamina is at once a point of pride and a safety requirement. Falling out of line is considered a severe transgression. After a couple of miles, we circled up for a briefing, and some of the firefighters turned away and retched unselfconsciously into the dirt. "We got a moderate Santa Ana wind for the first half of the day," a crew member said, examining a weather report and using the term for strong, dry winds that push into the area from the desert. Winds up to 40 miles per hour on the ridge tops, It's getting cooler, but the RH, relative humidity, is also getting lower. Wind both adds oxygen to the flames and transports them, and the drier the air and the drier the vegetation that feeds fires. A man named Ben was crew boss, meaning that the captain reported to him. The next few days, they're talking about Santa Ana's bringing winds up to 60 miles per hour, he said. 6-0, okay? From our position, more than a mile above sea level, we could see that the Eaton Fire was alive below us, wafting smoke from the low points between the mountains and creating an ethereal haze. Those steep canyons were too treacherous to hike into. A broken ankle would require an air evacuation, so the crew's assignment was to create a mile-long containment line in the peaks west of Mount Wilson Observatory. We would remove a 40-foot swath of vegetation to ensure that, even if winds energized the fire and made it another run, we don't get anything in Canada. As a member of the incident command had put it, Canada wasn't in danger, but there were hundreds of miles of dry forest to our north. There was also the risk that Santa Ana's would blow the fire into another densely populated part of Los Angeles. The crew spread out, and sawyers began to cut the chaparral with their saws. Their partners, known as swampers, grabbed it under brush and dragged it away. To gain a better vantage point on the fire, Ben and I hiked a mile toward an impoverished helispot at the end of the ridge. Ben, who was in his late 30s, was tall and lanky, the latter, he said almost apologetically, because he had lost a lot of weight last year while working the Park Fire in Northern California, which burned some 400,000 acres. He said that in 1 month he had hiked more than 100 miles to put in containment lines. He and the crew had done the same work that we were doing now, removing vegetation with chainsaws and hand tools, and had also strategically lit fires to starve the main fire of fuel. Last year's Smokehouse Creek Fire, which started in Texas, was even bigger than the Park Fire. It burned more than 1 million acres, making it a gigafire. Ben's adult life has been defined by fire. He became a firefighter after serving in the military. I've pretty much been on every mega fire in the last decade, he told me. In 2018, he and his mother were living in Paradise, California, when intense winds and abundant fuel helped the campfire grow into the deadliest and most destructive blaze in the state's history. He had a hard-won understanding that wildfires are incredibly difficult to fight in windy conditions. His and his mother's homes were destroyed. I was fighting to protect another person's house when mine burned, he said. There's a reason that old fire brigades used to show up with hooks. It's almost impossible to save the house. You can only pull it down to try and stop the spread. One difference between the campfire and the Eaton Fire, Ben said, is that the former happened in November, which is considered part of the fire season. Firefighters were prepared and had more resources, he told me. The fact that this fire is able to burn like this in January, that's weird. January is typically one of Southern California's rainiest months. Richard Seeger, a climate scientist with Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, told me that researchers attributed the unusual conditions to human-driven drying and warming climate change, combined with relentless Santa Ana winds and a possible nudge from an emerging La Niña. These factors together, he said, helped fuel an appalling inferno. Ben and I came to a dip at the top of a mountain ridge called a saddle. A steep slope covered with charred loose rock descended toward the fire. Hundreds of feet down, I could see a forested canyon. Bluish smoke was pouring from the trees. So far, the fire was not pushing its way toward us. A Chinook helicopter was circling, its rotors thumping, and we watched it dump an estimated 800 gallons of water on the trees. Beyond was the city of Los Angeles. and in the distance the shimmering coast where the Palisades fire had killed at least 10 and destroyed thousands of buildings. Ben had hoped to spend part of January in an ecological preserve along the coast of Central California, igniting piles of vegetation that he and his crew had painstakingly removed from an overgrown forest. The preserve was adopting an approach that is understood to make for a more resilient ecosystem, reintroducing fire to a landscape that hasn't been allowed to burn in centuries. "When we started, you couldn't see through the forest," Ben said. "Now there's a 15 to 20 foot spacing between the trees. It's beautiful." We watched an airliner size VLAT, short for Very Large Air Tanker, fly in the direction of the Palisades fire. It could carry thousands of gallons of pink fire retardant. Around midday, I hiked a little foot trail through thickets of mountain, white thorn, and scrub oak. I passed a crew of incarcerated firefighters who were blowing out or removing nearly all the vegetation from both sides of another saddle. Fires often halt as they crest a mountain, but strong winds can help them jump over saddles and ignite vegetation on the other side. The crew's sawyers were running their saws at full power. The rest of the crew had their heads down in concentration as they cleared brush. Every so often, one of the firefighters howled like a wolf, and the crew howled back. At one point, the superintendent of the incarcerated crew came over to chat with Ben. They compared observations on the weather and the fire. Then the superintendent asked Ben if he knew a young wildland firefighter who had learned the trade in prison and kept it up after his release. He had been killed by a falling tree a few years earlier. "I hired him," Ben said, surprised. "He was one of mine," the superintendent said. They both seemed moved to have made the connection, and for a while they just stood there and reminisced. His mom kept saying at the funeral how much he loved this job, Ben said. The crew I was with was remarkably diverse. Some of its members had learned wildland firefighting in prison. One had heard about it from a cousin. Another had seen a recruitment flyer. A rookie firefighter had just finished a year as a conscript in the Finnish military. The crew's lead EMT was a member of the Hopi tribe, a man who'd worked for a hotshot crew, essentially the special forces of firefighting, had been the first black firefighter to be named its rookie of the year. Unusually, one of the Sawyer teams was all female. One commonality among wildland firefighters is that they have an almost pathological aversion to the idea of being in an office or really any type of building. Their fondest work memories always seem to be about spiking out camping so far from any roads that food and supplies have to be airdropped in. Yet wildland firefighters are increasingly being drawn out of forests and mountains and into the growing numbers of suburbs and cities that border the wilderness. Some of the most terrifying fires in the so-called wilderness-urban interface have occurred in the past 3 years. Devastating fires in Boulder County and Maui began after droughts intensified by climate change sucked the moisture out of vegetation, drastically increasing what's called the energy release component, the available energy measured in BTUs per square foot within the flaming front of a fire. On the day the Eaton fire began, the energy release component was setting records for the season. Both fires involve power lines and brush. Intense winds then pushed their flames and embers through densely situated homes. Officials are investigating whether electrical infrastructure also started the Eaton fire. On my last day with the firefighting company, day 8 of the wildfire, the Santa Ana winds were predicted to return in force. Meteorologists warned of a particularly dangerous situation, a rare official designation used only for the worst conditions. The winds would test the containment line that Ben's crew had established. They were sent back into the mountains to make sure it held. at a mobile base that had been established early. Nearby, powder and water were being mixed into tens of thousands of gallons of fire retardant in anticipation of an extensive air attack operation that was meant to paint the ridge pink. On the hike in, I followed the most senior members of the crew, Josh, who grew up in South Central LA. He was homeless for a long time before he became a wildland firefighter a decade ago. Joss was a mentor to younger members of the crew, but he admitted he was kind of a big kid himself. He loved cereal. At fire camp, he slept with a Baby Yoda pillow and a blanket he had brought from home. He liked to compete in lucha libre competitions. This was Joss's first time fighting fire in his hometown, an experience he found surreal. A close family friend had been forced to evacuate her home in Altadena. "I love the camaraderie on fire," he said. Our feet crunched through the dirt. Everybody is from somewhere else. You have different political views, different religious views. We're all on the line together, working. We caught up with the rest of the crew, which had circled up for a briefing. A sudden gust hit us, and we all hunched our shoulders, bracing ourselves. "There's that wind," Joss said. A crew member taking weather readings up on the ridge was now registering 45 miles per hour winds. Reconnaissance helicopters flew in to gauge the conditions, and it soon became clear that the planned air operations would be unsafe and the retardant would probably scatter in the wind. "It's going to look like kids' finger painting," a voice said over the radio. A new plan was quickly devised. A hotshot crew would be sent into the canyon. They would put out as much of the heat as they could with hand tools and chainsaws. Near the top of the ridge, the charred skeletons of shrubs suggested that the fire had made a fierce upslope run several days earlier. At first glance, the entire landscape looked grim and desolate, but hawks were gliding on air currents, hunting for prey. A peregrine falcon landed on a dead branch and stayed for a while. A lizard scamped over sharp, blackened rocks. Satellite images of the Eaton fire showed that the mountain chaparral had burned with characteristic intensity. In canyons at higher elevations, however, images showed streaks of green where trees had survived. This type of patchwork landscape is called a mosaic, and fire scientists have studied it extensively. Mosaics have been shown to promote biodiversity and create gaps between fuel sources, which can interrupt or slow the spread of subsequent fires. I could hear the hotshot crew's chainsaws roaring. It seemed impossible to reconcile the potentially positive ecological benefits of fire up here with the wreckage at the base of the mountains. Such a reconciliation would require a profound realignment in our society, a shared understanding that our lives and our infrastructure must coexist with fire. The wind started to quiet down. I watched a helicopter complete its last water drop. The fire was still burning, but the line had held for another day. Before we hiked out, I spent a few minutes with Leo, a firefighter who was born and raised in the East Hollywood. He was wearing oil-stained chaps and carrying a red container of chainsaw fuel. He reminded me of something I'd asked the crew earlier. Was there anything they wanted people to know about their work? "It's devastatingly beautiful," Leo said. Sometimes the remote places he works strike him as sacred. He often wishes that he could show people scenes like this. A cold gale hit our backs, and I gripped my helmet to keep it on my head. If I lost it down the side of the mountain, I wasn't getting it back. Like many wildland firefighters, Leo was a seasonal employee, so he was laid off at the end of 2024 fire season. The assumption has always been that the risk tails off as winter approaches. Leo took a temporary job up north to make ends meet, and when he heard about the Los Angeles fires, he was hours away, installing cabinets with his dad. He couldn't believe that his own city was burning and he wasn't in a position to help. All he could think was, "I wish I could be there." 10 minutes later, he got a call telling him that crews were being mobilized. He left so quickly that he didn't pack any bedding. The first night in a tent at fire camp, he had to wrap himself in every piece of clothing he had. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Even then, he was cold, but the next day he started receiving grateful messages from friends in the area, and one of them drove over with a sleeping bag. "I've been fighting fire in California up and down for years," he told me. "They finally see what I do." M.R. O'Connor has contributed to the New Yorker since 2015. She is the author of Ignition, Lighting Fires in a Burning World. Comment: Trump's attempt to redefine America, the effect of the president's executive orders, was to convey an open season in which virtually nothing, including who gets to be an American citizen, is guaranteed, by Benjamin Wallace Wells. Cold bedevils presidential inaugurations, Washington, D.C., tending to be chilly in the third week of January. The New Yorker's correspondence in 1965, Lyndon Johnson's inaugural, donned red, white, and blue thermal underwear. The magazine's dispatch from 1977, Jimmy Carter's, noted, "shining white ice everywhere." Anticipating frigidity, the organizers of the 2025 iteration, Donald Trump's reprise, moved the event indoors to the Capitol's rotunda, whose limited capacity of 600 people helpfully delineated who was in and who was on the outs. In, the first family seated behind the president and punctuated visually by the 6 foot, 7 inch, 18-year-old Barron Trump. In, two, were the billionaires, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, and Google's Sundar Pichai, seated in the next row, and co-ideologues from abroad, Italy's Giorgia Meloni, Argentina's Javier Milei. Out, consigned to the Capitol Visitor Center, was Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, who at this point in 2023 enjoyed influence in the Republican Party broadly equivalent to Trump's, and whose sidelining was a reminder of what an extraordinary long time 2 years is in politics. 8 years is even longer. In the rotunda, Trump said that since his first election, "I have been tested and challenged more than any president in our 250-year history, and I've learned a lot along the way." Perhaps more important was what his movement had learned: the virtue of preparation. Detailed policy and hiring programs had been negotiated and assembled for American citizens. Trump said, "January 20, 2025 is Liberation Day." It was, if not that, executive order day. Papers flowed. At the Resolute desk, an aide handed Trump orders for signing from a tall stack of navy blue binders. Within a few hours, the United States was pulling out of not only the Paris Climate Accord, but also the World Health Organization, which it had helped to found in 1948. On immigration, the president reinstated his Remain in Mexico policy and canceled interviews for asylum applicants. In a Latino neighborhood in Detroit, ICE agents were reportedly going door to door. Federal diversity programs, some dating back to an executive order signed by LBJ in 1965, were eliminated. Offshore wind projects were paused. Restrictions on drilling lifted. 1,500 people were pardoned for their roles in January 6th, including some of the most violent actors. Politico speculated that many would soon run for office themselves. Some of the initiatives sounded less like amendments to bureaucratic procedure, the usual scope of executive orders, than like a manual for a startup society. Basic rules were being rewritten. Trump declared that the policy of the United States is that there are only two sexes, male and female. These sexes are not changeable and are grounded in fundamental and incontrovertible reality. Since the adoption of the 14th Amendment in 1868, any person born in the United States has been a citizen, but on Monday, Trump signed a document declaring that this is no longer so, that from now on, somebody born to parents who are in the country illegally, or even legally, but only temporarily, will not be an American. The effect of these executive orders was to convey, much more effectively than in 2017, an open season in which virtually nothing, from the boundaries of the U.S. to the solidity of jury verdicts to who gets to be an American citizen, is guaranteed. Meanwhile, we are awaiting deals. Trump's instincts are transactional, and he has his eye on Greenland and on its mineral deposits and on the Panama Canal. America's ships are being severely overcharged, he insisted, during a long riff in his inaugural address, and vowed, "We're taking it back." Having spent much of the past decade inveighing against what he saw as Chinese perfidy and promising a policy of high tariffs, he now indicated that he'll forget all about it if Beijing will sell 50% of TikTok to U.S. investors. Shaozi Chew, the CEO of TikTok, was in the rotunda too, seated next to Tulsi Gabbard. Were these gambits made on behalf of the country or certain supporters or Trump himself? The president's family at least got into the action early, issuing a dollar Trump meme coin a few days before the inauguration, which briefly surged to $15 billion in market capitalization before falling to around half of that. The day before the inauguration, they rolled out dollar Melania. The Trumps are always the Trumps, of course, but what has given the president a second political life is the way much of the country emerged from the pandemic, frustrated with rules, strictures, and the instructions of all types, with the principle behind them. What was once a niche campaign against diversity, equity, and inclusion programs has metastasized into a general anti-idealism, in pardoning the violent January 6 criminals and Ross Ulbricht, who created the crypto-enabled online drug bazaar Silk Road. Trump made it clear that accountability is for him to decide. Some billionaires, in particular, seem to detect a societal shift in Trump's election. Mark Zuckerberg is not long after canceling Meta's fact-checking program, told Joe Rogan that the culturally neutered corporate world could use more masculine energy, and that it would be good to celebrate the aggression a bit more. It took only a few days for the new president to take that sentiment and run right through the rule of law with it. Is he going too far for his own good again? Trump is often self-waylaying, as with last time around the Muslim ban and the never-ending boondoggle of the wall. And last week, even his supporters in the Fraternal Order of Police condemned the January 6 pardons. 22 Democratic state attorney generals filed suit to block the executive order threatening birthright citizenship. On Thursday, a federal judge blocked it temporarily, and at the National Cathedral, Trump had to endure a sermon from Bishop Marion Buddy, urging him to show compassion for the people who are scared now. But it is both bewildering and alarming to remember how furious and how widespread the resistance was to Trump's first presidential acts in 2017, the Women's March, the airport protests over the Muslim bans, and to notice how the response to a much more confrontational agenda has so far been marked mostly by a lone woman voice from a pulpit. One working week in, it looks as if Trump is right that he learned a lot from the past 8 years, and more than his opponents did. This January, what's missing is the heat. Benjamin Wallace Wells began contributing to The New Yorker in 2006 and joined the magazine as a staff writer in 2015. He writes about American politics and society. Here to their department, The college kids tracking your decongested commute. Benjamin Moschus, a senior, and his brother Joshua, a freshman, built the website that congestion pricing watchers rely on during a family trip to Japan by Dan Green. Congestion pricing's first month has offered New Yorkers plenty of immediate ways to measure its impact. Their easy pass bills, the decrease in honk inducing gridlock outside their windows, the number of exclamation points, and a bridge and tunnel uncle's Facebook posts. For more detailed analysis, the Times and other publications have turned to the Congestion Pricing Tracker, a website that collects data on commute times and displays them in a series of before and after line graphs. The data compilers, Benjamin and Joshua Moschus, are college-age brothers from Newton, Massachusetts, near Boston, who built the site during their winter break. "We feel like honorary New Yorkers of a sort," Benjamin said recently. The brothers sometimes visit Brooklyn and Staten Island to see family, but they usually don't drive into Manhattan, so they don't really have strong feelings, Benjamin added. The other day, the brothers convened on Zoom. Joshua, a freshman studying computer science at Northeastern, wore a scarlet school hoodie in front of a blank whiteboard on campus. Benjamin, in a gray t-shirt, had been at their parents' house beneath the wall-mounted maps on the eve of his final semester at Brown. Their project was inspired by Benjamin's study of taxi fare data for an econometrics competition held at the University of Chicago. Back at school, his thesis advisor, the economist Emily Oster, suggested that he look into the upcoming congestion pricing program. With his brother's help, Benjamin began pulling drive time estimates for 19 different city routes from Google Maps. Most choices were easy: tunnels, bridges, major thoroughfares across the congestion zone. When Benjamin wanted a Brooklyn route with lots of rush hour traffic but less traffic during the day, he called an outside consultant, a friend who grew up in Brooklyn. The result: a journey from South Slope to Dumbo via the BQE. That was his suggestion entirely, Benjamin said. After 2 weeks before the program launched, Benjamin pitched his brother on building a website. One hitch: they were on a family vacation in Japan, visiting ancient temples and sumo halls. "This was like a secondary priority for my parents," Joshua said. Benjamin was confident that the tolling would have an effect. "It just didn't seem right to me that you ask people to pay $9 and no one changes their behavior," he said. More surprising was how popular their tracker became in its first week. It had more than 100,000 users. On the Sunday that congestion pricing went into effect, the brothers were fielding messages and making sure that the tracker stayed tracking until 5 the following morning. "I don't even know how we were functioning," Benjamin said. Hours later, Joshua had to move back into his dorm and begin classes. "I think I got like 1 or 2 hours of sleep that day," he said. It was tough. Worse still, he had waited to pack until that morning. After a few weeks, they had begun to see clear patterns. During peak hours on the Williamsburg Bridge and other thoroughfares, commute time is down some 40%. Getting through the Holland Tunnel on a Sunday night, once a 30-minute slog, now takes 10. "We are very confident that this is not a fluke," Benjamin said. There have also been more moderate traffic increases in some spillover areas like the FDR. Perhaps most unexpectedly, travel times within the congestion zone have hardly budged. This mixed bag has allowed observers on all sides to crow. "We're reading one post that's like, 'Look at this graph of the Holland Tunnel. This is magical,'" Benjamin said. The very next post we see is someone like, "An increase in traffic, just like we expected in the Carey Tunnel. Same exact news source, same exact data." During the first weeks of this semester, Joshua spent most of his lectures reading and responding to tracker-related emails. "All but one of my classes are computer science classes, and I'm pretty good at computer science, so I don't necessarily need to pay attention, he said. The lone exception is an acting course that fulfills one of his major's requirements. I guess they want us to practice talking to people, he said. Benjamin admitted that the MTA was among those who'd reached out. About what? We don't like to comment on that, he said. The Moshi's original data storage plan cost them 6 cents for every 100,000 data requests. The first week's bill cleared $400. We were worried we'd be in debt, Benjamin said. They have since started a successful online fundraiser. At some point, a congestion pricing becomes a fact of life. They expect to end real-time updates. Probably when users stop actually looking at the website and we see that our traffic is close to doing nothing, Joshua said. Dan Green is a member of the New Yorker's editorial staff. Books. The insidious charms of the entrepreneurial work ethic. You're passionate, purpose-driven, dreaming big, working hard, making it happen, and now they've got you where they want you. By Anna Wiener. No literary form captures the pathologies of contemporary American work quite like the humble, honored, grateful, blessed LinkedIn post. In the right light, The Social Network for Professionals is a lavish psychoanalytic corpus bursting with naked ambition, inspiration, desperation, status seeking, spiritual yearning, brown nosing, name dropping, corporate shilling, and self promotion. Novels have been written about less, but no one is on LinkedIn for the prose. Recently, I visited the site after years of being away. A college classmate and talented artist was posting about the balancing act of being an effective solopreneur. A former business contact was sharing his professional journey with the moral, "Don't be afraid to change direction." A person identifying as ex-Meta encouraged hopeful Meta interviewees to show real connection to the mission and motivation. A director at a multinational brewing company that was hiring wrote, "Our mandate is to dream, challenge, question, and provoke." When did people start talking like this? LinkedIn's style of sanitized professional chatter, to say nothing of the robust cottage industry that exists to support it, from branding strategists and career coaches to software programs designed to generate shareable, safe-for-work content, is of a piece with mantras like "do what you love, follow your passion, bring your whole self to work, and make a life, not just a living." The linguistic trend extends beyond the domain of yoga classes and LED signage in co-working spaces. A recent Times article described Luigi Mangione, the 26-year-old accused of murdering the CEO of UnitedHealthcare, as possessing an entrepreneurial spirit in college because he resold Christmas lights. This discourse around work can seem like a distinctly modern phenomena. But a new book, Make Your Own Job, How the Entrepreneurial Work Ethic Exhausted America, Harvard, by Eric Baker, argues that the imperative to imbue work with personal significance is part of a long-standing national preoccupation with entrepreneurialism. Baker is a lecturer in the history of science at Harvard, an associate editor of The Drift, and a freelance writer for various publications, including this one. He sees his book as a corrective to conventional histories of mid-century American culture, which he believes overemphasize bureaucracy and conformism. As a study in intellectual history, Make Your Own Job is less concerned with the chronological development of American entrepreneurship than with the idea of it, the ways in which ordinary people have thought about their working lives, and how entrepreneurialism has become a value unto itself. Baker aims to track the anxieties and desires of a society undergoing epochal transitions and the evolution of what he calls the entrepreneurial work ethic, and an orientation that is highly individualistic and competitive, and that operates on the level of personality. It is present in the pervasive compulsion to work harder, longer hours, and to feel adrift and even devoid of purpose when there isn't enough work or the right work to do. The entrepreneurial work ethic, Baker writes, meets a fundamental ideological need by addressing a central tension of American capitalism. Most people need to work to earn a living, but well-paid, stable, and fulfilling jobs are hard to find. In times of intensifying economic inequality, when many of the jobs on offer are precarious, underpaid, and spiritually deadening, the prospect of becoming your own boss holds a lot of appeal. Entrepreneurialism is tenacious, Baker maintains, in part because it has the power to metabolize discontent with the present order of work. It suggests the possibility of liberation or relief, an exit or a workaround. The ethic, he also notes, tends to be popular during periods of acute unemployment. The result is too many people working too much too hard because there's just not enough work. Before the entrepreneurial work ethic became widespread, in Baker's account, what predominated was the industrious work ethic, in which labor of any kind was considered a moral good and framed in terms of stoicism and duty. The industrious work ethic applied to workers in mills and on Henry Ford-style assembly lines, and echoes of it could be seen in middle-class organization men who were loyal to their employers and received loyalty in return. Workers submitted to a company, whether IBM or General Motors, and slotted themselves into bureaucratic structures that discouraged risk-taking and did not reward individualism. This orientation toward work was buffered, in part, by strong labor unions and a relatively sturdy social safety net. If the industrious work ethic advanced a certain kind of static moralism, Baker writes, the entrepreneurial work ethic was a dynamic philosophy of personal development. The notion that one's unique personality could be transmuted into prosperity and opportunity had broad appeal at a time of economic instability and cultural transformation. Baker identifies a number of practices and traditions from the first half of the 20th century as embodying entrepreneurialism from New Thought, an influential spiritual movement that championed the transcendence of the mind over material reality to direct selling networks. Now you are in business for yourself, Avon told its salespeople. But the industrious work ethic prevailed well past the middle century mark, with many workers accepting mental or physical drudgery in return for security and predictability. It was not until the later decades of the century that the entrepreneurial work ethic came into full force. Though entrepreneurial capitalism might have been a bit onerous in its implicit mandate to both generate opportunities and fulfill them, it was also presented as a more creative, even kinder alternative to the industrial capitalism that preceded it. The idea of a workplace in which entrepreneurialism could be exhibited at every level was entrenched by self-help writers and what Baker calls management intellectuals, consultants, corporate executives, business journalists, and other predecessors of today's TED Talk thought leaders. One of the most prominent of these was Peter Drucker, an Austrian-born American writer, consultant, and professor. His breakthrough book was Concept of the Corporation, 1946, a sort of ethnography and appraisal of General Motors. In his view, the personal satisfaction of employees was essential to a company's bottom line. Large organizations run properly could instill a sense of purpose and dignity, even among rank-and-file workers, which would in turn maximize productivity and profits. Drucker was especially taken with the ideal of the entrepreneurial manager, an inspiring, creative, personable leader who cultivated loyal, productive, and enterprising employees. In an environment where American democracy was seen as inextricable from American capitalism, the entrepreneur could be a heroic figure. In 1949, Drucker wrote a column for Fortune in which he claimed that entrepreneurialism was a matter of national interest. He believed that corporations fulfilled a crucial political function. Entrepreneurial managers could foster a sense of citizenship and national responsibility in their subordinates. Entrepreneurship, it would follow, was practically patriotic, a bulwark against authoritarian and totalitarian ways. By the 80s, Drucker had become one of the most prominent management intellectuals in the US. That decade brought corporate restructuring, deepened inequality, and waves of consultants and career business gurus. Among them was Tom Peters, an ex-McKinsey consultant who emerged as a public figure with the 1982 mega bestsellers In Search of Excellence. Peters and his co-author, Robert Waterman, took stock of the previous decade's flailing economy, identified companies that had survived inflation, high interest rates, global competition, and corporate bloat, 3M, Johnson & Johnson, Frito-Lay, and explained to readers how American industry might learn from such success stories and recover. The book highlighted the importance of corporate culture, a workplace identity that can enable employees to feel a sense of agency, ownership, and purpose in their day-to-day work. And that's all we have time for today. By Anna Weiner. She's a contributing writer at The New Yorker covering the Bay Area, technology, and the cultural influence of Silicon Valley. She is the author of the memoir Uncanny Valley. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for joining me this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.